it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On My Mind this week, major news from Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into ties between the Trump administration and Russia. As the public learns more from the secretive world of Mueller's prosecution, it seems people are holding their breath for the big one, the thing that cracks it all open. But Benjamin Wittes says not so fast. Wittes is editor-in-chief of the blog Lawfare and a close follower of the various investigations surrounding Trump and his associates. Wittes says if there is a moment that will bring down President Trump, it's not going to be legal, it will be political. Benjamin Wittes joined me in the studio Thursday morning. Ben Wittes, thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure to see you again.
Thank you. Talk about the news this week, a sentencing memo from Robert Mueller for Michael Flynn. First, back us up and tell us about Flynn's role in this Russia investigation.
Well, Michael Flynn, who was the president's first national security advisor for a remarkably short number of days, was the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency in the last administration and had a bit of a falling out with President Obama and was one of the few really high-profile major national security figures to support President Trump. And as a result, ended up being sort of on the stage with him a great deal. One of the things that seems to have brought them together was a kind of affinity for Russia. And Michael Flynn had some sort of peculiar relationships of his own with Russian entities. And during the transition, there were, as listeners will recall, a series of weird interactions between the transition and Russian figures, particularly the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak. All of these interactions, or many of them, involved Michael Flynn. And when the FBI came and interviewed him about those interactions, particularly the conversations with Kislyak about sanctions, Michael Flynn did not tell the truth. He also later did not tell the truth about some lobbying activity he had been engaged in with respect to Turkey. And that was the subject of the plea agreement. Those false statements were the subject of the plea agreement he entered into about a year ago, the sentencing for which is coming up now.
So this sentencing memo has the fact that Mueller is recommending no prison time for Flynn. How come?
Well, there's two things that are important to say about that. The first is that the guideline sentencing range for somebody in Flynn's position, that is somebody who's accused, pleads guilty to false statements, and who doesn't have a previous criminal record. And Flynn not only doesn't have a criminal record, he's a general, he has a very distinguished service record. So that guideline sentence to begin with is 0 to 6 months. So, you know, you're not starting with somebody who would normally be serving a long prison sentence. You're starting with somebody who cut himself a deal to reduce the number of charges that he's facing to one false statements or set of false statements issues. In addition, prosecutors have the authority under Rule 5K1 of the sentencing guidelines to request a downward departure when somebody gives them what is called in the guidelines substantial assistance.
So is it your conclusion then that Michael Flynn has done his part in this investigation to answer questions that perhaps no one else could have?
Yeah, it's not my conclusion. It's Bob Mueller's conclusion. So much of the memo is not public, at least.
It's redacted.
It's redacted, and including all the details of how he cooperated, how he helped, but that he provided substantial assistance to multiple investigations on repeated occasions. He was interviewed, you know, I think 19 times, is clear as day in the memo. And Mueller, in recognition of that, requests that he serve at the lower end of the sentencing guidelines, including no incarceration.
What is your conclusion as to why so much of that material was redacted?
The material is redacted because the investigations in question are ongoing. And one thing Bob Mueller has shown is enormous information discipline. We learn what he's up to when he's good and ready for us to learn what he's up to. He is not ready to lay his cards down on any of the three investigative matters at issue in that memo. And therefore, he, you know, took a big black pen and redacted the relevant material.
Now, explain the three elements of that memo.
Yeah, so we don't really know very much about any of them. The one that we know the most about is the Russia investigation. He's provided substantial assistance in the basic Russia investigation, and including this was not redacted, important material related to what was going on in the transition. Presumably, that's a reference to the communications between the transition and the Russians in this period about which he then made false statements originally. In addition, there seems to be a criminal matter connected to the Russia investigation that he's assisting in. It's completely unclear what that is. And then there's this third criminal matter, which is completely redacted altogether. Now, the New York Times reported yesterday that one of those criminal matters was a series of issues around lobbying about Turkey, which, as you'll recall, Michael Flynn also told some untruths about. So we think, we're not sure, but we think one of those matters is a broader investigation of people who were kind of, you know, illegally lobbying on behalf of Turkish interests. But we don't know, and the other matter is completely opaque.
Gosh, so much going on this week. In addition, both Maryland and the District of Columbia have issued subpoenas regarding claims that the president is violating the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. Now, first, remind us of what that is and then how this case has played out.
So the Emoluments Clause is one of those parts of the Constitution that Donald Trump has introduced to the public. Emoluments is a multisyllabic 18th century word for gifts and payments. And basically what the Foreign Emoluments Clause says is that officers of the United States, including the president, cannot receive emoluments from foreign governments while they are in office. The basic idea is you should be serving only the United States. And there is a question, and it's a complicated set of questions, whether running a hotel that foreign governments spend money at, right? So, you know, you run the Trump International Hotel and the Saudi government sends a delegation to Washington and they're spending a lot of money to put up people in the hotel. Now, the president's contention is that that is not an emolument. That's a business transaction, right?
And that he has nothing to do with that?
And he, well, so I'm just telling you what the position
is. Sure, yeah.
You know, their position is that an emolument is a payment to him. And this is a fair market business transaction with an entity he happens to own. It's at an arm's length from him. The states of Maryland and the District of Columbia do not buy this. And there has been a litigation for a while as to the legality of the president's continuing to run a business that does business with foreign governments. In the last week, that has moved to the phase of litigation that involves discovery. And so now we are starting to see the plaintiff states starting to go after factual information,
documents,
rather than simply litigating the, for example, the motion to dismiss the points of law that underlie the litigation.
Now, one court has already seen this, and in fact, what you and others believe is that this may end up in the Supreme Court?
I have no doubt that at the end of the day, the Supreme Court will not let a lower court decide the question of whether the president of the United States is illegally operating a hotel. I think it's possible if the president wins at the lower court level, you could imagine the Supreme Court saying this isn't that interesting a question. But if the president loses at the lower court level and a lower court were to say it is unlawful for the president of the United States to be running the Trump International Hotel, which, you know, is a few blocks from the White House, right? I can't imagine that the Supreme Court would not see itself as required to resolve the question of whether the lower court got that right.
So as you and I are speaking on Thursday morning, we are expecting more news tomorrow, Friday, in regard to Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort. What are you looking for?
So those are two things that could end up being dramatic fireworks or could end up being disappointing. In Michael Cohen's case, which I think is the more likely one to be disappointing. I could be wrong about that. And by the time anybody listens to this, that might sound like a foolish statement. But in the Michael Cohen case, we're expecting a sentencing memorandum. So the government, like with the Flynn case, will have to lay out the scope and nature of his cooperation and what they're recommending sentence-wise. Michael Cohen has asked for no jail time. I suspect the government will not concur in no jail time, but I do think they're likely to ask for a substantial downward departure on the basis, the same as Flynn, of substantial assistance to, you know, multiple investigations. In this case,
even though Michael Cohen has already admitted that he lied.
Correct. In fact, precisely because he's admitted that he lied, that he lied about Trump Tower Moscow in one case, and in the other case of most relevance to the president, that he was involved in these campaign violations through payments to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal to cover up their affairs with the president at the direction, as he has testified, of Donald Trump. I think that precisely because he was so involved in this activity, his testimony and assistance is likely extremely valuable. And I think prosecutors, both in the special counsel's office and in the Southern District of New York, are likely to recommend some degree of leniency as a result of that. The problem from a consumer of information point of view is that, as with Flynn, I suspect the prosecutors are not ready to lay their cards on the table and tell us everything that happened. And so I think this sentencing memo, we're likely to get some headlines of Cohen's cooperation, as with Flynn, that he cooperated extensively, that they're recommending leniency. But I suspect we're not going to get, or I would be surprised if we got, a kind of detailed account from either Mueller or the Southern District of their theory of what his cooperation has meant.
But Michael Cohen has acknowledged now that he was negotiating with the Russians for a Trump facility, if you will, in Moscow, up to and during the 2016 election campaign.
You know, not just during, well into it.
Right.
That deal, those negotiations, including direct contacts between Michael Cohen and the Kremlin, were happening as late as June of 2016, is the sort of when it finally fell apart. So, look, eventually we are going to learn both the Southern District of New York's theory of the payments to Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels' case, and Mueller's theory of whether and how the Trump Tower Moscow deal interacts with the larger question of collusion with Russia during the 2016.
Collusion, a word we've heard a great deal from
yes.
the president all about.
It's a word I use very advisedly because it actually has no legal meaning. But, what role, if any, people on this side of the Atlantic Ocean had in the Russian intervention in the 2016 election? Eventually, we're going to learn the government's theory of those two cases. I would be surprised if we learned that in the Cohen sentencing memo this week. The Manafort memo, I think, is going to have some fireworks in it.
Such as?
All right. So Paul Manafort, like—
Who's already in jail.
Yeah, Paul Manafort is in a world of hurt. And to listeners who might be thinking about committing a major money laundering operation and then, not cooperating with prosecutors and not reaching a plea deal and then lying to them after you reach a plea deal— take Paul Manafort's story as a cautionary tale of how much trouble you can dig yourself into in that regard. And this is a man who at this point may well spend the rest of his life in prison. This was not inevitable. You know, he was offered a lot of chances to cooperate. In contrast to these other two that we've just talked about, Michael Cohen and Michael Flynn, both of whom are going to live to have the rest of their lives. And we don't know how much time Michael Cohen is going to spend in prison, but he's going to have a life after that. And Paul Manafort, I think, is very likely not to have a life after.
But what about the president's possible pardon?
Well, so that's his one big chance, I suppose. But before he gets to that phase, he does have to deal with the fact that the special prosecutor has accused him of breaching his plea agreement, committing additional crimes, and lying after he had agreed to cooperate. And the special prosecutor promised in the last filing, which was, God, I lose track of time now, last week or the week before, sometime in there, that he would file a detailed memo outlining Manafort's breach of the agreements. That is the memo that is due on Friday. You know, it takes a lot to get prosecutors this upset at you. And so I think that story is likely to be pretty dramatic.
But how serious could that be in perhaps inhibiting President Trump from pardoning Manafort?
So I sort of make it my business never to try to live inside the president's head, because it's sort of bad for my mental health to try. And so, like, you know, he says what he says. He has definitely dangled the possibility of pardons. I think pardoning Paul Manafort, given the things that he's been accused of and now convicted of and pled to, should be unthinkable. And I would hope that the things that we're going to learn about him in this memo would make it even more unthinkable. That said, the president keeps evidently thinking about it. And so I don't really know what to make of that. And, you know, that's something that he's going to have to answer for in one way or another, either electorally or to Congress in some form or another. But I can't sit here and tell you what the president is thinking or planning in that regard.
And now a quick break. When we come back, more from Benjamin Wittes.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Benjamin Wittes, editor-in-chief of Lawfare and a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. Should the president pardon Manafort, I wonder whether there are any other legal options that other prosecutors might have, whether the special counsel Robert Mueller could bring back, even if the president were to pardon Manafort?
So the pardon power is one of the great sledgehammers of presidential power. It doesn't really have a lot of checks on it. And I think there's a few possible answers to that question. One is that, you know, the federal pardons are only for federal crimes, right? And so if you imagine that Paul Manafort has potential criminal exposure in states, you could imagine a state government bringing that case. The other possibility, of course, is that depending on how the pardon is worded, if it is a pardon only for the crimes that he has been indicted for and convicted of, and there were other crimes that the special prosecutor is aware of and could prove beyond a reasonable doubt, you could imagine an additional federal case. The problem is once you've pardoned somebody once, if the prosecutor indicts him again, what's really to stop you from doing it again? So I think, you know, if the president decides to pardon Paul Manafort, Paul Manafort will walk out of jail on the basis of that pardon. The question in my mind is really what price the president will pay for the exercise of the pardon, not whether the pardon would be valid.
How do you think congressional Republicans would react to such a pardon?
I think with embarrassment, but I have not yet seen a lot of signs from congressional Republicans of willingness to do things about President Trump's excesses. And so my suspicion is that you would have some combination of expressed clucking disapproval or just kind of embarrassed silence and a lot of outrage from Democrats.
As you've written recently in The Atlantic, you don't expect either one of these filings to be the big one that's going to shape everything.
Yeah, I think one of the pernicious features of the way we discuss this set of issues is that everybody keeps waiting for the tripping of the house of cards, right? The single news event that's going to cause a collapse in President Trump's support and whether you think of it as the big one or the house of cards coming down or the row of dominoes, that there's some one big event that brings it all down. And I think that's exactly the wrong way to think about it. I think the architecture of Trump's power and hold on a community of voters and political supporters is actually more robust than that, and that it's kind of time for a different metaphor for the way we think about the kind of degradation of his support, both through these news events and through the law.
Bentonwood, is aside from Mueller's investigation, are there others out there that could be equally relevant, equally important to what's happening in these various areas?
I don't know that equally. Mueller is the big fish, but he's not the only fish. So the Southern District of New York prosecutors who brought the first Cohen case, the one on the campaign finance matters, that is a very serious problem for the president. And in some ways, in a direct sense, it's a more serious problem than Mueller, because it involves a very direct allegation by Cohen that he was acting at the direction of the president, right? And so it implicates the president pretty directly in a way that the Mueller stuff, at least so far on the Russia side, does not do. In addition, the state attorney general of New York has an active civil litigation against the Trump Foundation. The New York State tax authorities are investigating Trump's tax compliance. And the Mueller investigation itself has a number of discrete components, some of which we've talked about here, and one big one of which we have not, which is there's a major investigation of whether the president tried to obstruct justice through the bullying of Justice Department and FBI officials, the firing of the FBI director, the demands for particular substantive outcomes from Jim Comey. You know, so I think the best way to understand this relationship, as I sort of described in that Atlantic article with Michaela Fogel, is as a siege. This is a bunch of armies camped outside in a big circle around the Castle Trump. And there is a long-running degradation of the walls of this castle. It's not going to be one big bomb that blows it all up. It's going to be this sort of slow chipping away at the walls until someday there will be a political, if it ever happens, a political decision happens to scale those walls and sack the city.
A political decision and not necessarily a legal decision.
People forget this, but presidents do not get brought down by legal decisions. Even Watergate, you know, the Supreme Court ordered the release of the tapes. Leon Jaworski, the special prosecutor, indicted and prosecuted all the people around the president. President Nixon resigned when Republican senators came to him and said, your position is unsustainable, you're going to be impeached and removed, and your support in the legislature is gone. That's a political moment, not a legal moment. The law inflects those political moments. It conditions those political moments. But what actually caused Richard Nixon to resign was when his political position became unsustainable.
You also are likely to have congressional investigations beginning early next year when Democrats take over the House.
Yes, and that's a big, as Michaela and I describe in the piece, that's not an army that's currently camped out around the castle, but it is an army that's marching to the castle. And, you know, since November, there has not been any force between that army and the castle, and it's going to arrive, and it is a group of, the president likes to call Mueller's office 17 angry Democrats. Leave aside how inappropriate that characterization is of a group of professional prosecutors. This is several hundred actually angry Democrats, and they're going to be in control of congressional committees. And there is a lot of pent-up interest in the part of Democratic members in oversight that did not take place over the last couple of years. And those committees are itching to go.
One last question. Do you think the Mueller investigation is winding down?
I think it is likely winding down, but I think that may not mean what people think it means. So when people say the Mueller investigation is winding down, and there was a big Yahoo News story by Mike Isikoff to that effect, the image that people have is, okay, they didn't find anything, pack up, go home, you know, this is the end. I don't think that's what it means. So first of all, winding down may mean something very different to a group of prosecutors than it means to readers of the newspaper. To a group of prosecutors, what that means is that they have done the bulk of their work. They have a few residual things that they need to finish in order to finish the investigation, and then they have to make their prosecutorial decisions. Now, one, those residual things can take a lot of time to resolve. So Bob Mueller has, I believe, at least two pending cases in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals related to grand jury matters. Major litigations like that can take weeks or months to resolve. The losing party has the option of requesting Supreme Court review. May or may not get it, but it takes a long time to find out you're not going to get Supreme Court review. So when we say winding down, we think it means, okay, we've finished up business. And I think what prosecutors mean when they say things are winding down is they fully understand the scope of work. They've heard from the relevant people. They basically know what the major decisions are going to be, and they have discrete matters to finish. So point number one about winding down is it can take a lot of time to wind down.
Right.
Point number two, getting to decision points is not the same thing as answering the question, what are the substance of those decisions going to be? So, you know, one possibility is, you know, assuming now we're all wound down and we're at decision day, one possibility is we didn't find anything, pack up, go home, it all fizzles out. Possibility number two, winding down means we're all done with the investigation. Now we're going to bring the cases, right? And here are the big indictments at the end of the investigation. That's possibility number two. Possibility number three, which I think is probably the most likely possibility, is that the major outcome of the investigation is some kind of written work product. People talk about the Mueller report as though we kind of know what it's going to look like. I don't know what it's going to look like, but I do think there's some major piece of written work product at the end of the investigation. And so if what winding down means is we're getting closer to the day when we get this piece of work product, probably in combination with a couple of additional prosecutions, I'm not sure the president should be breathing a big sigh of relief about winding down in that context.
Ben Wittes, thank you so much.
It's good to see you.
Thank you. And that's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher and Natalie Yurev-Lipker. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.